your tie tonight. Sit on down tonight. Sit down tonight. Hey! Tonight. Hey! Tonight. Baby! Tonight. Yeah! Think about the sacrifices made for you.
I'm Donna from Claverack, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM.
Tune in to Quintron's Weather Warlock, a custom-built weather-controlled analog synthesizer that turns the changes in the weather into sounds. New Orleans-based artist Quintron installed one of his series of custom-built weather-controlled analog synthesizers in the Wavefarm Study Center, with sensors outside detecting the differences and changes in the weather. Here, the precipitation, the sunlight, the wind, and the temperature turned into soundscapes anytime, 24 hours a day, at wavefarm.org/listen, or click on the listen button at any WGXC.org page. One of the many web streams available to listen anytime, Quintron's Weather Warlock, available through Wavefarm.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies. Here it is, the 6th of November, and you're listening to another edition of Goodnight Norman on WGXC 90.7 FM on the radio dial in the Columbia and Greene counties. Tower in Acra, and WGXC.org in most of the rest of the world. Tonight I'm going to read, or this morning, I'm going to read from the Lydia Davis Omnibus, Collected Stories. The first story is Story, by Lydia Davis, circa 19, from her first collection, Break It Down, 1986. Story, I get home from work, and there's a message from him. That he is not coming, that he is busy. He will call again. I wait to hear from him. Then at 9 o'clock, I go to where he lives, find his car, but he's not home. I knock at his apartment door and then at all the garage doors, not knowing which garage door is his. No answer. I write a note, read it over. write a new note and stick it in his door. At home, I am restless, and all I can do, though I have a lot to do, since I'm going on a trip in the morning, is play the piano. I call again at 10:45, and he's home. He has been to the movies with his old girlfriend, and she's still there. He says he'll call back. I wait. Finally, I sit down and write in my notebook that when he calls me, either he will then come to me or he will not, and I will be angry. And so I will have either him or my own anger. And this might be all right, since anger is always a great comfort, as I found with my husband. Then I go on to write, in the third person and the past tense, that clearly she always needed to have a love, even if it was a complicated love. He calls back before I have time to finish writing all this down. When he calls, it is a little after 11:30. We argue until nearly 12. Everything he says is a contradiction. For example, he says he did not want to see me because he wanted to work, and even more because he wanted to be alone. But he has not worked, and he has not been alone. There is no way I can get him to reconcile any of his contradictions, and when this conversation begins to sound too much like many I had with my husband, I say goodbye and hang up. I finish writing down what I started to write, even though by now it no longer seems true that anger is any great comfort. I call him back 5 minutes later to tell him that I am sorry about all this arguing and that I love him, but there's no answer. I call again 5 minutes later, thinking he might have walked out to his garage and walked back. But again, there is no answer. I think of driving to where he lives again and looking for his garage to see if he is in there working, because he keeps his desk there and his books, and that is where he goes to read and write. I am in my nightgown. It is after 12, and I have to leave the next morning at 5. Even so, I get dressed and drive the mile or so to his place. I am afraid that when I get there, I will see other cars by his house that I did not see earlier, and that one of them will belong to his old girlfriend. When I drive down the driveway, I see two cars that weren't there before, and one of them is parked as close as possible to his door, and I think that she is there. I walk around the small building to the back where his apartment is and look in the window. The light is on, but I can't see anything clearly because of the half-closed Venetian blinds and the steam on the glass. But things inside the room are not the same as they were earlier in the evening, and before, there was no steam. I open the outer screen door and knock. No answer. I let the screen door fall shut, and I walk away to check the row of garages. Now the door opens behind me as I'm walking away, and he comes out. I can't see him very well because it is dark in the narrow lane beside his door, and he is wearing dark clothes, and whatever light there is behind him. He comes up to me and puts his arms around me without speaking, and I think he is not speaking, not because he is feeling so much, but because he is preparing what he will say. He lets go of me and walks around me and ahead of me out to where the cars are parked by the garage doors. As we walk out there, he says, look, and my name, and I am waiting for him to say that she is here, and also that it's all over between us, but he doesn't. And I have the feeling he did intend to say something like that, at least say that she was here, and that he then thought better of it for some reason. Instead, he says that everything that went wrong tonight was his fault, and he's sorry. He stands with his back against the garage door, and his face in the light, and I stand in front of him with my back to the light. At one point, he hugs me so suddenly that the fire of my cigarette crumbles against the garage door behind him. I know why we're out here and not in his room, but I don't ask him until everything is all right between us. Then he says, she wasn't here when I called you. She came back later. He says the only reason she is there is that something is troubling her, and he is the only one she can talk to about it. Then he says, you don't understand, do you? I try to figure it out. So So they went to the movies and then came back to his place, and then I called, and then she left, and he called back, and we argued, and then I called back twice, but he had gone out to get a beer, he says, and then I drove over, and in the meantime, he had returned from buying beer, and she had also come back, and she was in his room, so we talked by the garage doors. But what is the truth? Could he and she both really have come back in that short interval between my last phone call and my arrival at his place? Or is the truth really that during his call to me, she waited outside, or in his garage, or in her car, and that he then brought her in again, and that when the phone rang with my second and third calls, he let it ring without answering because he was fed up with me and with arguing? Or is the truth that she did leave and did come back later, but that he remained and let the phone ring without answering? Or did he perhaps bring her in and then go out for the beer while she waited there and listened to the phone ring? The last is the least likely. I don't believe, anyway, that there was any trip out for beer. The fact that he does not tell me the truth all the time makes me not sure of his truth at certain times. Then I work to figure out for myself if what he is telling me is the truth or not. Sometimes I can figure out that it's not the truth. Sometimes I don't know and never know. Sometimes, just because he says it to me over and over again, I am convinced it is the truth, because I don't believe he would repeat a lie so often. Maybe the truth does not matter, but I want to know it. If only so that I can come to some conclusions about such questions as whether he is angry at me or not. If he is, then how angry? Whether he still loves her or not? If he does, then how much? Whether he loves me or not? How much? How capable he is of deceiving me in the act, and after the act, in the telling. So we're going to hear the stories by Lydia Davis, one of my favorites. Look, I apologize, I have to have a little technical difficulty here. I'll be right back. You're listening to Norman Douglas on Good Night, Norman, on the morning of November 6th. Live on the radio on WGXC 90.7 FM in the beautiful Hudson Valley, Columbia and Greene counties, broadcasting to you live from a tower in Acre and on WGXC.org across most of the rest of the world. Hold on. Okay, I apologize. It didn't take long, I guess. I'm reading again on Good Night, Norman, from Lydia Davis, and out of her first story collection right now, in the omnibus of her collected stories, which came out a few years ago. This is called Break It Down. He's sitting there, staring at a piece of paper in front of him. He's trying to break it down, he says. I'm breaking it all down. The ticket was $600, and then after that, there was more for the hotel and food and so on for just 10 days, say $80 a day. No, more like $100 a day. And we made love, say, once a day on the average. That's $100 a shot. And each time it lasted maybe 2 or 3 hours, so that would be anywhere from $33 to $50 an hour, which is expensive. Though, of course, that wasn't all that went on, because we were together almost all day long. She would keep looking at me, and every time she looked at me, it was worth something. And she smiled at me and didn't stop talking and singing. Something I said, she would sail into it, a snatch. For me, she would be gone from me a little ways, but smiling, too, and tell me jokes, and I loved it, but didn't exactly know what to do about it, and just smiled back at her and felt slow next to her, just not quick enough. So she talked and touched me on the shoulder and the arm. She kept touching and stayed close to me. You're with each other all day long, and it keeps happening, the touches and smiles, and it adds up, it builds up, and you know where you'll be that night. You're talking, and every now and then you think about it. No, you don't think, you just feel it as a kind of destination. What's coming up after you leave wherever you are all evening? And you're happy about it, and you're planning it all, not in your head, really, somewhere inside your body or all through your body. It's all mounting up and coming together so that when you get in bed, you can't help it. It's a real performance. It all pours out. But slowly, you go easy until you can't anymore. Or you hold back the whole time. You hold back and touch the edges of everything. You edge around until you have to plunge in and finish it off. And when you're finished, you're too weak to stand. But after a while, you have to go to the bathroom and you stand up. Your legs are trembling. You hold on to the door frames. There's a little light coming in through the window. You can see your way in and out, but you can't really see the bed. So it's not really $100 a shot because it goes on all day from the start when you wake up and feel her body next to you and you don't miss a thing, not a thing of what's next to you. Her arm, her leg, her shoulder, her face, that good skin. I felt other good skin, but this skin is just the edge of something else. And you're going to start going. And no matter how much you crawl all over each other, it won't be enough. And when your hunger dies down a little, then you think how much you love her. And that starts you off again. And her face, you look over at her face and can't believe how you got there and how lucky. And it's still all a surprise, and it never stops, even after it's over. It never stops being a surprise. It's more like you have a good 16 or 18 hours a day of this going on. Even when you're not with her, it's going on. It's good to be away because it's going to be so good to go back to her. So it's still here, and you can't go off and look at some old street or some old painting without still feeling it in your body. And a few things that happened the day before that don't mean much by themselves or wouldn't mean much if you weren't having this thing together. But you can't forget, and it's all inside you all the time. So that's more like, say, 16 into 100 would be $6 an hour, which isn't too much. And then, it really keeps going on while you're asleep, though you're probably dreaming about something else, a building maybe. I kept dreaming every night almost about this building, because I would spend a lot of every morning in this old stone building, and when I closed my eyes, I would see these cool spaces and have this peace inside me. I would see the bricks of the floor and the stone arches and the space, the emptiness between, like a kind of dark frame around what I could see beyond, a garden. And in this space was like stone too, because of the coolness of it and the gray shadow, that kind of luminous shade that was glowing with the light of the sun falling beyond the arches. And there was also the great height of the ceiling. All this was in my mind all the time. Though I didn't know it until I closed my eyes. I'm asleep, and I'm not dreaming about her, but she's lying next to me, and I wake up enough times in the night to remember she's there, and notice, say, once she was lying on her back, but now she's curled around me. I look at her closed eyes. I want to kiss her eyelids. I want to feel that soft skin under my lips, but I don't want to disturb her. I don't want to see her frown as though in her sleep she has forgotten who I am and feels just that something is bothering her. So I just look at her and hold on to it all. These times when I'm watching over her sleep and she's next to me and isn't away from me the way she will be later. I want to stay awake all night just to go on feeling that, but I can't. I fall asleep again, though I'm sleeping lightly, still trying to hold on to it. But it isn't over when it ends. It goes on after it's all over. She's still inside you, like a sweet liquor. You're filled with her. Everything about her has kind of bled into you. Her smell, her voice, the way her body moves, it's all inside you, at least for a while after. Then you begin to lose it, and I am beginning to lose it. You're afraid of how weak you are, that you can't get her all back into you again, and now the whole thing is going out of your body, and it's more in your mind than your body. The pictures come to you one by one, and you look at them. Some of them last longer than others. You are together in a very white, clean place, a coffee house, having breakfast together, and the place is so white that against it you can see her clearly, her blue eyes, her smile, the colors of her clothes, even the print of the newspaper she's reading when she's not looking up at you, the light brown and red and gold of her hair when she's got her head down reading, the brown coffee, the brown rolls, all against that white table and those white plates and silver urns and silver knives and spoons, and against that quiet of the sleepy people in that room sitting alone at their tables with just some chinking and clattering of spoons and cups and saucers, and some hushed voices, her voice now, and then rising and falling. The pictures come to you, and you have to hope they won't lose their life too fast and dry up. Though you know they will, and that you'll also forget some of what happened, because already you're turning up little things that you nearly forgot. We were in bed, and she asked me, "Do I seem fat to you?" And I was surprised, because she didn't seem to worry about herself at all in that way, and I guess I was reading into it that she did worry about herself, so answered what I was thinking and said stupidly that she had a very beautiful body, that her body was perfect, and I really meant it as an answer. But she said kind of sharply, "That's not what I asked." And so I had to try to answer her again, exactly what she had asked. And once she lay over against me late in the night, and she started talking, her breath in my ear. And she just went on and talked faster and faster. She couldn't stop, and I loved it. I just felt that all that life in her was running into me, too. I had so little life in me, her life. Her fire was coming into me, in that hot breath in my ear, and I just wanted her to go on talking forever right there next to me, and I would go on living like that. I would be able to go on living, but without her, I don't know. Then you forget some of it all, maybe most of it all, almost all of it, in the end, and you work hard at remembering everything now so you won't ever forget. But you can kill it, too, even by thinking about it too much, though you can't help thinking about it nearly all the time. And then, when the pictures start to go, you start asking some questions, just little questions that sit in your mind without any answers, like why did she have the light on when you came into bed one night, but it was off the next, but she had it on the night after that, and she had it off the last night, why, and other questions, little questions that nag at you, like that. And finally the pictures go, and these dry little questions just sit there without any answers, and you're left with this large, heavy pain in you that you try to numb by reading, or you try to ease it by getting out into public places where there will be people all around you. But no matter how good you are at pushing that pain away, just when you think you're going to be all right for a while, that you're safe, you're kind of holding it off with all your strength, and you're staying in some little bare, numb spot of ground, then suddenly it will all come back. You'll hear a noise. Maybe it's a cat crying or a baby, or something else like her cry. You hear it, and make that connection in a part of you you have no control over, and the pain comes back so hard that you're afraid. Afraid of how you're falling back into it again, and you wonder, no, you're terrified to ask how you're ever going to climb out of it. And so, it's not only every hour of the day while it's happening, but it's really for hours and hours every day after that, for weeks, the less and less, so that you could work out the ratio if you wanted. Maybe after 6 weeks, you're only thinking about it an hour or so in the day altogether. A few minutes here and there, spread over, or a few minutes here and there, and half an hour before you go to sleep, or sometimes it all comes back and you stay awake with it half the night. So when you add all that up, you've only spent maybe $3 an hour on it. If you have to figure in the bad times too, I don't know. There weren't any bad times with her, though maybe there was one bad time when I told her I loved her. I couldn't help it. This was the first time this had happened with her. Now it was half falling in love with her, or maybe completely if she had let me, but she couldn't, or I couldn't completely because it was all going to be so short, and other things too. And so I told her, and didn't know of any way to tell her first that she didn't have to feel this was a burden, the fact that I loved her, or that she didn't have to feel the same about me, or say the same back, that it was just that I had to tell her, that's all, because it was bursting inside me, and saying it wouldn't even begin to take care of what I was feeling. Really, I couldn't say anything of what I was feeling because there was so much. Words couldn't handle it, and making love only made it worse, because then I wanted words badly, but they were no good, no good at all. But I told her anyway. I was lying on top of her, and her hands were up by her head, and my hands were on hers, and our fingers were locked, and there was a little light on her face from the window, but I couldn't really see her, and I was afraid to say it, but I had to say it, because I wanted her to know. It was the last night. I had to tell her then, or I'd never have another chance. I just said, before you go to sleep, I have to tell you before you go to sleep that I love you. And immediately, right away after, she said, I love you too. And it sounded to me as if she didn't mean it, a little flat. But then it usually sounds a little flat when someone says, I love you too, because they're just saying it back even if they do mean it. And the problem is that I'll never know if she meant it, or maybe someday she'll tell me whether she meant it or not. But there's no way to know now, and I'm sorry I did that. It was a trap I didn't mean to put her in. I can see it was a trap, because if she hadn't said anything at all, I know that would have hurt too. As though she were taking something from me and just accepting it and not giving anything back. So she really had to, even just to be kind to me. She had to say it, and I don't really know now if she meant it. Another bad time, or it wasn't exactly bad, but it wasn't easy either, was when I had to leave. The time was coming, and I was beginning to tremble and feel empty. Nothing in the middle of me, nothing inside. And nothing to hold me up on my legs. And then it came. Everything was ready, and I had to go. And so it was just a kiss, a quick one, as though we were afraid of what might happen after a kiss. And she was almost wild then. She reached up to a hook by the door and took an old shirt, a green and blue shirt, from the hook, and put it in my arms for me to take away. The soft cloth was full of her smell, and then we stood there close together, looking at a piece of paper she had in her hand, and I didn't lose any of it. I was holding it tight, that last minute or two, because this was it. We'd come to the end of it. Things always change, so this was really it. Over. Maybe it works out all right. Maybe you haven't lost for doing it. I don't know, really. Sometimes when you think of it, you feel like a prince, really. You feel just like a king. And then other times you're afraid. You're afraid. Not all the time, but now and then. For what it's going to do to you. And it's hard to know what to do with it now. Walking away, I looked back once, and the door was still open. I could see her standing far back in the dark of the room. I could only really see her white face still looking out at me, and her white arms. I guess you get to a point where you look at that pain as if it were there in front of you 3 feet away, lying in a box, an open box, in a window somewhere. It's hard and cold, like a bar of metal. You just look at it there and say, all right, I'll take it. I'll buy it. That's what it is, because you know all about it before you even go into this thing. You know the pain is part of the whole thing. And it isn't that you can say afterwards the pleasure was greater than the pain, and that's why you would do it again. That has nothing to do with it. You can't measure it, because the pain comes after, and it lasts longer. So the question really is, why doesn't that pain make you say, I won't do it again? When the pain is so bad that you have to say that, but you don't. So I'm just thinking about it, how you can go in with $600, more like $1,000. Or you can come out with an old shirt. All right, that happy tale by Lydia Davis from her omnibus collection of fiction, short stories, collected stories by Lydia Davis. Once again, you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. Again, WGGXC. Okay, this one's kind of fun. This is called The Mouse. From the same collection, still from 1986. I should read some later stories, because, you know, she's still around, old Lady Davis. In fact, she last I knew. She lives not far from here. Right here in the Hudson Valley. The Mouse. First a poet writes a story about a mouse in moonlight and the snow. How the mouse tries to hide in his shadow. How the mouse climbs up his sleeve and he shakes it down into the snow before he knows what it is that is clinging to his sleeve. His cat is nearby and her shadow is on the snow, and she is after the mouse. A woman is then reading this story in the bath. Half her hair is dry and half of it is floating in the bathwater. She likes the story. That night she can't sleep and goes into the kitchen to read another book by the same poet. She sits on a stool by the counter. It is late and the night is quiet, though now and then at some distance a train passes and hoots before crossing. To her surprise, though she knows it lives there, a mouse comes out of a burner from under a pot and sniffs the air. Its feet are like little thorns. Its ears are unexpectedly large. One eye is shut and the other open. Excuse me. It nibbles something off the tray of the burner. She moves and it flashes back in. She is still and in a moment it comes out again. And when she moves again, it flashes back into the stove like a snapped elastic. At 4 in the morning, though she is still wide awake, reading and sometimes watching the mouse, the woman closes her book and goes back to bed. In the morning, a man sits in the kitchen on a stool, the same stool by the counter, and cradles their young cat in his arms, holding her neck in his broad pink hands and rubbing the crown of her head with his thumbs, and behind him the woman stands leaning against his back, her breasts flattened against his shoulder blades, her hands closed over his chest, and they have laid out crust of bread on the counter for the mouse to smell and are waiting for the mouse to come out, blindly, and for the young cat to get it. They stay this way wrapped in nearly complete silence, and they are nearly motionless. Only the man's gentle thumbs move over the cat's skull, and the woman sometimes lays her cheek down against the man's fragrant soft hair, and then lifts it again, and the cat's eyes are shifting quickly from point to point. A motor starts up in the kitchen. There is the sudden flare of the gas water heater, the swift passage of some cars on the highway below, and then a single voice in the road. But the mouse knows the company that is there and won't come out. The cat is too hungry to keep still and reaches forth one paw and then another and frees herself from the man's light hold and climbs up on the counter to eat the bread herself. Often, whenever she can get into the house or is let into the house, the cat crouches sleepily on the counter by the stove, her eyes pointed at the burner where the mouse is likely to appear. But she is not more vigilant than that, half asleep, as though she likes just to place herself in this situation, hunting the mouse, but perfectly motionless. Really, she is keeping the mouse company, the mouse vigilant or sleeping inside the stove, the cat nearby outside. The mouse has had babies in the stove, and the cat too is carrying kittens in her body, and her nipples are beginning to stand out in the downy fur of her belly. The woman often looks at the cat and sometimes remembers another story. The woman and her husband lived in the country in a large empty house. The rooms in this house were so large that the furniture sank into the empty spaces. There were no rugs, and the curtains were thin, the window panes cold and wintry, and the daylight and the electric lights at night were cold and white and lit the bare floor, and the bare walls did not change the darkness of the room. On two sides of the house, beyond the yard, were stands of trees. One woods was deep and thick and climbed away up over a hill. At the bottom of the hill was a marshy pond in the trees where the water had been caught by the railroad embankment. The tracks and ties were gone from the embankment, and the mound of it was overgrown with saplings. The other stand of trees was thin and bordered a meadow, and deer crossed through to sleep in the meadow. In the winter, the woman could see their tracks in the snow and follow where they leaped in from the road. When the weather grew cold, the mice would start coming into the house from the woods in the meadow and run through the walls and fight and squeak behind the baseboards. The woman and her husband were not troubled by the mice, except for the little black droppings everywhere, but they had heard that mice would sometimes chew through the wires in the walls and start fires. So they decided to try and get rid of them. The woman bought some traps at the hardware store made of bright brassy coils of metal and new raw wood printed with red letters. The man at the hardware store showed her how to set them. It was easy to get hurt because the springs were very strong and tight. The woman had to be the one to set them because she was always the one who did things like that. In the evening, before they went to bed, she set one carefully, afraid of snapping her fingers, and put it down in a place where she and he would not be likely to walk on it when they came into the kitchen in the morning, forgetting it was there. They went to bed, and the woman stayed awake, reading. She would read until the man woke up enough to complain about the light. He was often angry about something, and when she read at night, it was the light. Later in the night, she was still awake and heard the sound like a gunshot of the trap springing, but did not go downstairs because the house was cold. In the morning she went into the kitchen and saw that the trap had flipped over and there was a mouse in it and blood smeared around on the pink linoleum. She thought the mouse was dead, but when she moved the trap with her foot she saw that it was not. It started flipping around on the linoleum with the trap closed on its head. Her husband came in then, and neither of them knew what to do about this half-dead mouse. They thought that the best thing would be to kill it with a hammer or some other heavy thing, but if one of them was going to do it, it would be her, and she did not have the stomach for it. Bending over the mouse, she felt sick and agitated with the fear of something dead or nearly dead or nearly dead. Both of them were excited and kept staring at it and turning away from it and walking around the room. The day was cloudy, with more snow coming, and the light in the kitchen was white and cast no shadow. Finally, the woman decided to just throw it outside, get it out of there, and it would die in the cold. She took a dustpan and pushed it under the trap and the mouse, and walked quickly with it out the wooden door to the porch, and through the porch and out the storm door, and down the steps, afraid all the time that it would jump again and slip off the dustpan. She walked down the pitted concrete walk and across the driveway to the edge of the woods and through the trap and the mouse out onto the frozen crust of snow. She tried to believe the mouse didn't feel much pain and was in shock anyway. Certainly a mouse did not feel exactly the way a person would, lying with his head closed in a trap, bleeding and freezing to death out there on the white crust of snow. She could not be sure. Then she wondered if there was any animal that might come along and be willing to eat a mouse that was already dead but preserved by the frost. They did not look for the trap later. In midwinter, the man left, and the woman lived on in the house alone. Then she moved to the city, and the house was rented to a school teacher and his wife, and a year later, sold to a lawyer from the city. The last time the woman walked through it, the rooms were still empty and dark, and the furniture set against the bare walls, though it was different furniture, had the same look of defeat under the weight of that emptiness. Okay, that was The Mouse, by Lydia Davis, from her omnibus collected stories. I mean, there's some real good ones here. You could really, like, read it any time, all the time, I think, personally. Okay, this is from her next collection from 1997. It's called Meat, M-E-A-T, comma, My Husband. Meet My Husband by Lydia Davis. My husband's favorite food in childhood was corned beef. I found this out yesterday when friends came over and we started talking about food. At some point they asked what our favorite childhood foods had been. I couldn't think of any, but my husband didn't have to think before answering, "Corned beef," he said. "Corned beef with an egg on it," one of our friends added. My husband often ate in diners before we met. He had two he liked, but he preferred the one where they did a particularly good hot roast beef sandwich. He still likes a good piece of roast beef or steak or hamburger mixed with sauce and spices and grilled outdoors with brochettes of onions and peppers. But I'm the one who cooks most of his meals now. Often I make him meals with no meat in them at all because I don't think meat is good for us. Often there's no seafood in them either, because most seafood isn't good for us either. And there is almost never any fish in them, partly because I can't remember which sort of fish may be safe to eat, and which are almost certainly not. But mainly because he likes fish only when it's served in a restaurant, or cooked in such a way that he can't tell it's fish. Often there is no cheese in our meals either, because of the problem with fat. I'll make him a brown rice casserole, for example, or winter bitch vegetables with parsley sauce, or turnip soup with turnip greens, or white bean and eggplant gratin, or polenta with spicy vegetables. "Why don't you make the foods I like?" he asks sometimes. "Why don't you like the foods I make?" I answer. Once I marinated slabs of tofu in tamari sauce, champagne vinegar, red wine, toasted marjoram, and dried Chinese mushrooms simmered in water. I marinated them for 4 or 5 days and then served them to him sliced thin in a sandwich with horseradish and mayonnaise, slices of red onion, lettuce, and tomato. First he said the tofu was still very bland, which is what he always says about tofu. Then he said that on the other hand, if he hadn't known it was there, he wouldn't have been able to taste the tofu anyway, because there were so many other things in the sandwich. He said it was all right, and then he said he knew tofu was good for him. Sometimes he likes what I make, and if he's in a good mood, he says so. Once I made him a cucumber salad with feta cheese and red onion, and he liked it, saying it tasted Greek. Another time I made him a lentil salad with peppers and mint, and he liked that too, so he said it tasted like dirt. But generally he doesn't like what I cook as much as what he used to eat in diners, and certainly not as much as what he used to make for himself before he met me. For instance, he used to make a roulade of beef cooked in a marsala sauce. He would take thin slices of top round or sirloin, dust them with flour, coat one side with crushed dill seeds, roll them around cooked Italian sausage meat, and pierce them with a toothpick. Then he would sauté them in butter and simmer them in a brown marsala sauce with mushrooms. He would also make roulades of veal stuffed with prosciutto and gruyere. Another favorite was a meatloaf of veal, pork, and sirloin. It would contain garlic, rosemary, 2 eggs, and whole wheat breadcrumbs. He would lay smoked bacon underneath it and on top of it. Now the loaf I make for him is of ground turkey. It too has mushrooms, fresh whole wheat breadcrumbs, and garlic in it, but in other ways it is not the same. I make it with 1 egg, celery, leeks, sweet red peppers, salt and pepper, and a dash of nutmeg. Outdoors on the deck, he eats it and says nothing, gazing over the water past the willow tree. He is calm and contemplative. I don't think he's calm because I'm feeding him so much less meat, but because he is teaching himself to accept that I do. He doesn't like it, but knows that I believe I'm doing it for his own good. When he says nothing about the turkey loaf, I question him, and when I press him to answer, he says that it's all right, but he's not excited about it. He excuses himself by saying that in general, he's not very excited about food. I disagree, because I have seen him excited about food, though almost never about what I serve him. In fact, I can remember only one occasion on which he was excited by what I served him. It was the night I made polenta and spicy vegetables for our dinner, though that was not what excited him. The polenta, spreading in a thick ochre circle under the heap of reddish-brown vegetables, looked strange and reminded us both of a cow patty. When he had eaten some of it, though, my husband said it tasted better than it looked, something he had said before about other meals of mine. The cookbook had suggested a certain dessert to follow, a ripe pear chilled with walnuts. As we sat down to our meal, I told my husband what I was planning for dessert, though I was not going to bother chilling the pear. That's one of my problems as a cook, that I don't bother to do each thing the way it should be done. I don't seem to understand the importance of detail in cooking. My husband does, and when I told him my plans for dessert, he got right up from the table and put the pear in the freezer to chill. When we came to eat the pear and the walnuts, the contrast between the cool, juicy sweetness of the fruit and the warmer, oily fragrance of the nuts certainly excited my husband enough for him to imagine other desserts of fruit: poached figs with ginger, apricot fritters, and sliced blood oranges with pecans. Certainly he was more excited about this dessert than he had been about anything else I had served him, but then he was the one who had put the pear in the freezer, and I've learned by now that when he's involved in preparing a meal, or anything else for that matter, he's more apt to like it. All right, I'm drawing around to like the last quarter of an hour here. It's from the second collection, 1997, Two Sisters is the name of the story. Two Sisters. Though everyone wishes it would not happen, and though it would be far better if it did not happen, it does sometimes happen that a second daughter is born and there are two sisters. Of course, any daughter crying in the hour of her birth is only a failure and is greeted with a heavy heart by her father, since the man wanted sons. He tries again. Again, it is only a daughter. This is worse, for it is a second daughter. Then it is a third and even a fourth. He is miserable among females. He lives in despair with his failures. The man is lucky who has one son and one daughter, though his risk is great in trying for another son. Most fortunate is the man with sons only, for he can go on son after son until the daughter is made, and he will have all the sons he could wish for and a little daughter as well to grace his table. And if the daughter should never come, then he has a woman already, and his wife, the mother of his son. In himself, he is not a man. Only his wife has that man. She could wish for a daughter, having no woman, but her wishes are hardly audible, for she is herself a daughter, though she may have no living parents. The single daughter, the many brothers' only sister, listens to the voice of her family and is pleased with herself and happy. Her softness against her brother's brutality, her calm against their destruction, is admired. But when there are two sisters, one is uglier and more clumsier than the other, one is less clever, one is more promiscuous. Even when all the better qualities unite in one sister, as most often happens, she will not be happy, because the other, like a shadow, will follow her success with green eyes. Two sisters grow up at different times and despise each other for being such children. They quarrel and turn red, and though if there is only one daughter, she will remain Angela, two will lose their names and be stouter as a result. Two sisters often marry. One finds the husband of the other crude. The other uses her husband as a shield against her sister and her sister's husband, whom she fears for his quick wit. Though the two sisters attempt friendship so that their children will have cousins, they are often estranged. Their husbands disappoint them. Their sons are failures and spend their mother's love in cheap towns. Strong as iron only is now the hatred of the two sisters for each other. This endures as their husbands wither, as their sons desert. Caged together, two sisters contain their fury. Their features are the same. Two sisters, in black, shot for food together. Husbands dead, sons dead in some war. Their hatred is so familiar that they are unaware of it. They are sometimes tender with each other because they forget. But the faces of the two sisters in death are bitter by long habit. So writes Lydia Davis in her omnibus of collected stories. And I'm reading to you right now. The next story comes right after that. It's even shorter. It's called The Mother. The girl wrote a story. But how much better it would be if you wrote a novel, said her mother. The girl built a dollhouse. But how much better if it were a real house, the mother said. The girl made a small pillow for her father. But wouldn't a quilt be more practical, said her mother. The girl dug a small hole in the garden. But how much better if you dug a large hole, said her mother. The girl dug a large hole and went to sleep in it. But how much better if you slept forever, said her mother. Lydia Davis, breaking it down. That story was titled The Mother. This one is titled Mothers. Everyone has a mother somewhere. There is a mother at dinner with us. She is a small woman with eyeglass lenses so thick they seem black when she turns her head away. Then the mother of the hostess telephones as we are eating. This causes the hostess to be away from the table longer than one would expect. This mother may possibly be in New York. The mother of a guest is mentioned in conversations. This mother is in Oregon, a state few of us know anything about, though it has happened before that a relative lived there. A choreographer is referred to afterwards in the car. He is spending the night in town. On his way, in fact, to see his mother again in another state. Mothers, when they are guests at dinner, eat well like children, but seem absent. It is often the case that they cannot follow what we are doing or saying. It is often the case also that they enter the conversation only when it turns on our youth. Or they accommodate, or accommodation is not wanted, smile, and are misunderstood. And yet mothers are always seen, always talked to, even if only on holidays. They have suffered for our sakes, and most often in a place where we could not see them. Big book, sorry. From a third collection, it's called The Rape of the Tonic Woman. Women, sorry. By Lydia Davis. One day when the Tanuk men were away from their village hunting, an entire village of Chunut men came to their igloos and raped their women to satisfy an old grudge. When the Tanuk men returned and saw the traces of blood and tears, they vowed to take revenge for this insult and immediately left for the village of the Tunich, several days' journey away over the thick coastal ice. They knew they would find the Tunich men sleeping, as only men can sleep who have raped and traveled several days through the bitter winds of midwinter. Yet when they arrived in the Tunich village and crept through the passageways into the Tunich igloos, they found them cold and empty. They hacked off pieces of frozen meat from Tunich seal carcasses and chewed them as they deliberated upon their next move. But in the absence of the Tanuk men, as the Tanuk women slowly recovered their calm, the Tunich men came creeping into their camp again and down the passageways into their igloos. Again the Tunich men lay with the Tanuk women and vanished into the vast stretches of sunless, ice-bound land that lay beyond the circle of igloos. While this was happening, however, the Tunich women returned to their camp and found the Tanuk men dozing there in frustration. Too disheartened to rape the Tunich women in revenge, as they might have done, the Tanuk men left them in order to search for the Tunich men elsewhere. As they started home, Migurk, the south wind, filled the air with snow and made it difficult for them to walk. They struggled on through the wall of dancing flakes, and suddenly before them they saw the shapes of men. They sprang with bloodlust, thinking vengeance was within reach, yet the shapes of men melted away at their touch and reformed at a distance. Though the Tanuk men attacked them again and again, they could not harm them, for these were not the Tunich, as the Tanuk thought, but merely polar spirits. Several days later, the Tanuk men reached their village and the igloos of their crazed wives and sisters. As their men had remained away, the women had been visited a third time by the Tunich, and then, as though that were not injury enough, by the polar spirits as well, and they no longer recognized their own husbands and brothers. Their fear did not leave them until the sun rose in the spring. Only then, as the ice began to loosen its hold and the waters to reappear, did their eyes rest once again gently on their husbands and brothers. Okay, this is probably going to be the last story of the night. All these stories are from collected stories of Lady Davis, A Real Tone. This story is called What I Feel. These days, I try to tell myself that what I feel is not very important. I've read this in several books now. What I feel is important, but not the center of everything. Maybe I do see this, but I do not believe it deeply enough to act on it. I would like to believe it more deeply. What a relief that would be. I wouldn't have to think about what I felt all the time and try to control it with all its complications and all its consequences. I wouldn't have to try to feel better all the time. In fact, if I didn't believe what I felt was so important, I probably wouldn't even feel so bad, and it wouldn't be so hard to feel better. I wouldn't have to say, oh, I feel so awful. This is like the end for me here in this dark living room late at night with the dark outside under the street lights. I am so very alone. Everyone else in the house asleep. There is no comfort anywhere. Just me alone down here. I will never calm myself enough to sleep. Never sleep. Never be able to go on to the next day. I can't possibly go on. I can't live even to the next minute. If I believed that what I felt was not the center of everything, then it wouldn't be, but just one of many things off to the side, and I would be able to see and pay attention to other things that were equally important, and in this way I would have some relief. But it is curious how you can see that an idea is absolutely true and correct, and yet not believe it deeply enough to act on it. So I still act as though my feelings